Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, May 24th. Before we start our business, let's have a roll call for attendance, please.
Representative Levy.
Levy present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you. We have several items on the agenda today. Five items. I plan to cover them all. We have four work sessions and a public hearing. For those of you tuning in to listen or watch as we get our business done today, we have two work sessions at the beginning where we will very likely be taking motions and moving those bills out. The next two are for discussion purposes only. And even though it doesn't mention it on the printed agenda, House Bill 2357A, we do plan to have some discussion, but we do not plan to have motions or move that bill today. The public hearing will be the last item on our agenda today. I'm ready to start the agenda. Looks like everyone else is. Opening a work session on House Bill 3143.
Chair, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern for Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3143 would start the clock for interest accrual on late property taxes 1 month late or on December 15th of the property tax year. And there is a potential revenue impact, but it's unknown. It would just be that 1 month portion of the year for current interest accrual. And just for context, the 3 year period that the counties and the Department of Revenue pursue late property tax payments, the entire amount of interest over that period that's collected annually for 3 years of payments is $33 million.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. McGovern, that $33 million, that's like all the interest collected or penalties collected. That's not just in the first month. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that also would include someone that was, I'm sorry, Vice Chair Reschke, Chair Nathanson, that would also include someone who is, say, a year and 9 months late. So it's that entire 3 years. And then, of course, it accumulates and gets larger as you sort of get later and later in that period.
Thank you.
So what I'm getting from the question and response is $33 million sounds like a really big revenue hit, but that is not the revenue hit we're expecting from this particular bill. It's something much less than that.
Chair Nathanson, that's absolutely correct. $33 million is not the revenue impact of this. That's just for context in terms of total annual collections for 3 years worth of pursuing late property taxes.
Good, thanks. Any other questions for LRO? Representative Reschke, do you have another question now? Probably not.
Nope, I am. That was my one question for this bill, so.
All right.
Take my hand.
It looks like we're ready for a motion.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 3143.
Vice Chair Pham moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 3143. Is there any discussion on this Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just want to appreciate the assessors who had issues with trying to implement the originally proposed bill language, and really, I think, worked with us to understand the intention here, which is to recognize that sometimes taxpayers can be a little overwhelmed. To charge them for a full month of interest when they missed a day is a pretty heavy weight. And I appreciate that the assessor is going to work on this and helping us come up with a solution.
Thank you for the comment. Any other discussion on this motion? Roll call vote, please.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. Another motion. Rep Pham.
Apologies, Chair Nathanson. I was saying on mute, Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 3143 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Pham moves House Bill 3143 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Roll call vote, please.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Representative Reschke. And I think there may be a problem with that connection. Rep Reschke, I recommend you close your camera for a moment. And turn on the mic so that you can vote now.
I vote aye. Reschke votes aye.
Thank you.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson votes aye. Motion passes. This bill is moving to the floor. We do need to assign a carrier, not in my notes, but looks like we do need to assign a carrier, and that should be Representative Nose. That completes the work on this bill. Is that correct? I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3143. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2551A.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, House Bill 2551A is a bill that would extend one of the existing law tax credits that's up for its sunset renewal this legislative session. So in this case, House Bill 2551A is relating to the tax credit that's available to taxpayers that make a contribution to an individual development account, or the Individual Development Account Program, or the IDA program. So House Bill 2551A would extend the existing law sunset 6 years from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2028. And it also would make some programmatic changes to the underlying IDA program as well. We do have the paperwork on this one, the revenue impact statement. It's issued, it's up there and available in OLIS. It's about $6.5-7 million per year by extending the credit. The fiscal impact is minimal. Earlier we had indication that Ways and Means might have wanted to take a look at this. It seems that is no longer the case. So this bill is available to go to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for Mr. Easton? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, this bill does not have any further amendments to it. Is that correct? It's just 2551A.
That is correct, Representative Reschke, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion before we hear a motion?
Are you ready for a motion?
I am.
Chair Nathanson, I move House Bill 2551A to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill's referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and be replaced with a referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures.
Thank you. Vice Chair Reschke moves House Bill 2551A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill's referral to Joint Ways and Means be rescinded and replaced with a referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Rep. Reschke, did I get it right?
I think so. I'd ask LRO, but yeah, I think so.
Okay. Is there any discussion? I'll wait another few seconds in case anyone's trying to find the right place to raise a hand. I'm not seeing any. It looks like we're ready for a roll call vote.
Representative Levy.
Levy votes yes.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh votes yes.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith votes aye.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama votes aye.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham votes aye.
Vice Chair Reschke.
I think we have a frozen connection again. Rep. Reschke, could you turn your camera off and your mic on so that you can vote? The connection appears to be frozen.
I texted him.
Thank you. Let's wait a little bit.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, Rep. Reschke.
Reschke votes aye.
Thank you. Did that
Madam,
yes?
I was saying, Madam Chair Nathanson, for your vote.
Nathanson votes aye. Does that complete the roll call now? From my count, it does.
Yes.
Okay. Motion passes. House Bill 2551A is going to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. Did that complete our work on 2551A? It appears that it does. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2551A. The next bill, House Bill 2357A. I'm opening a work session. Representative Marsh. Oh, I can't hear you. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. In regard to 2551, I just wanted to make a note on the record that I hope we will continue to watch how these tax credits do. We've had some some diverse experience in whether the tax credits are actually being taken up by taxpayers and providing the benefit that we want them to have for the IDA. So just a note that we're going to want to continue to watch that and make sure this continues to be a good financial mechanism for the program.
Thank you for the comment. And I hope that comment carries on to the next committee, JCTE. Thank you. Okay, we're opening a work session now on House Bill 2357A. This will be for the purpose of discussion. Committee members, this is a bill that we've heard before, and we had a work session. Since then, there has been an additional amendment. And if there's anything the committee wants to discuss about this bill, now's a good time. Questions to ask of LRO or any other kinds of discussion. So the floor is open. I'll wait a few seconds to see if any hands go up. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Mr. Easton on this bill, or who from LRO is on this one?
This is Jamie McGovern.
It's Ms. McGovern. Okay, Ms. McGovern, I saw there was an A6 and an A7. I don't know if you're prepared to discuss both of those, but I'm curious what LRO's initial thoughts are on both of those amendments.
Vice Chair Reschke, Chair Nathanson, I have an SMS up in OLIS, and so in the dash six, both the dash six and the dash seven do some reconstruction of the OFRI board and the appointments. So in the dash seven, we have that the total number of voting board members changes from 11, which is under current statute, and to 13. I have up in the meeting materials a grid that kind of talks about, that compares some of the different changes, but I'll just keep describing them.
Ms. McGovern, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. If the committee or the public who's listening, if you have access to look at that document in meeting materials, I do recommend it. It's a nice sort of like comparison chart on what the base bill, the dash six and the dash seven do. So you can see how they work. I think it's called Table of Policies in the meeting materials.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. And so, yeah, so right now we have 11 voting board members under current statute, and the dash seven would add two voting members, one from the environmental community, one from Fish and Wildlife Science. And then specifies that one of the non-voting members would be a member of the public, but unaffiliated. In the little table that I have, that is the table of policies, the two stars next to any of the entries means that they would be appointed by the state forester. So you can see under current statute that we have the voting members. Those are all appointed by the state forester. And then you could see the ones that have one star next to them. Those would be some of, like, for instance, in the dash A7, next to the one member from the environmental community and the one with the Fish Wildlife Science, those would be jointly appointed by the Senate president and the Speaker of the House. So that is... that's some of the changes that we see in the A7, and that's the in terms of the board members. The A6 changes the construct of the board members as well, but instead of 13, there's now 12 members, 9 producers, a small forest landowner, an hourly wage employee, and then appointed from the Senate President and Speaker of the House one member. That member is specified to have an active interest in the positive development and economic growth of the forest products industry in the state. So there's a little bit of difference in change of the composition from current statute and the A6 and the A7. There's some changes in funding as well. So in the A7, I think we spoke about it last time, there's a reallocation of the current funds that go to OFRI, and there's now established under the A7, the Sound Forestry Practices subaccount and the Family Forest Land subaccount out of the revenues that currently are collected with the OFRI assessment portion of the forest products harvest tax. The A6 increases the, it doesn't change the OFRI funding from current statute, but it does increase the ORIS Forest Land Protection Fund rates for the landowner assessment portion. And so currently those are 7.5 cents per acre east of the Cascades and 5 cents per acre west of the Cascades. That would bump them up to 12.5 cents and 10 cents per acre respectively. So those are the changes in the funding for the A6 and the A7. And then there's just a little bit of compliance there, which I put at the bottom of the chart, all the details of the compliance. And essentially, you know, you have that the voting and non-voting board members have to be compliant with or be, you know, fit the qualifications that are listed there below, be a citizen of the United States, bona fide resident of the state, and some other components. But the A6 specifies that the members that are voting and producers of under 20 million board feet per year don't have to comply with those specifications at the bottom. And then that's in the A6, but in the A7, you have that the non-voting members don't have to fill those qualifications. So it's a little bit of an exemption from the qualifications for the non-voting or voting members, depending if you're talking about the A6 or the A7. And then there's a few things that are in the SMS that are not in the grid that I have because, well, they just aren't. So in the newest amendment that we're seeing, which is the dash A6, it establishes what's called an intellectual property definition for the purposes here. Adds some allowable activities to the Oregon Forest Lands Resources Institute, specifically formulation and implementation of public policy. It also adds engagement with local, state, and national, international, private organizations. And taking that intellectual property definition, it adds development and governance of intellectual property to approve activities. That's I think that's the most of it. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Pham.
I apologize. My computer is having, thank you, Madam Chair. My computer is having a little delay. Yes, thank you so much, Ms. McGovern. Could you explain a little bit more the intellectual property in the dash A6 amendment? I don't quite understand intellectual property with respect to OFRI. And I think if you could give me an example, that might help me understand the intellectual property part.
Rep. Pham, Chair Nathanson, I apologize. I've been working on this amendment since I received it, and I don't quite understand. I don't know what the scope of intellectual property would be, so I'm going to have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. Understood.
Representative Marsh. Rep. Marsh.
Thank you. Got it. Thank you, Chair. Jamie, thank you for the table, which is very useful. I was trying to figure out additionally, we have a bill that came to us from the Ag Committee. And I was trying to figure out additionally what the difference is between that bill that's come to us is as reflected in this chart. And it looks like the main difference between that bill and the A7 is the appointments, but can you confirm that for me?
Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, do you mean the base bill or the A version of the bill?
Yes.
Yes. Just let me take care.
Because really we have four items to consider, right? We have the base bill, current statute, and the two amendments.
Representative Marsh, that's mostly correct. I think in looking at my notes here that the specification of the board members to be, no, they were also in the environmental community. Yeah, I think that's the main difference.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Smith, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Gang, I really feel like I tried to follow along in this conversation, but I'm missing something. What is the core issue we're trying to get at with this piece of legislation? Can somebody help me understand that?
I could.
Go ahead, Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So I'll take a stab at that. For me, I think it has to do with this idea of a publicly supported agency and making sure that there's some guidelines and sidebars about how public dollars can be used for lobbying on behalf of the logging industry. And so I think in this bill and in the amendment, it's to try to explicitly prohibit the use of tax dollars to lobby on behalf of the logging industry. And I think that's what I'm guessing the intellectual property has to do with for the A6 amendment is it's a more expansive definition. It allows some use for digital advertising of O3 dollars to do some lobbying support, while the other amendment prohibits, the base bill prohibits the use of any tax dollars and instead directs it towards other funds outside of OFREE. So basically it was the investigations that were done by the Oregonian and ProPublica who raised some of the concerns around OFREE, which should be by its charter is prohibited from doing direct lobbying. And so that's the problem that this bill is trying to solve.
I see. Thank you for that input. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Rep. Pham, you did have your hand up. Do you want to go next? And that will be followed by Rep. Reschke and then Rep. Levy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I did mostly answer it, raise what I needed to raise. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McGovern, in your chart, from the current statute and the A6, they're both $4 million in annual revenue. And so I recall reading, I don't remember if it's in the base bill or the A6, that the advertising budget goes away. So I'm just trying to understand the budget, how both.
Rep. Reschke, I'm sorry, but we're missing most of your words, the last sentence or two. Can you start over? I want to make sure we get the whole thing.
Sure, thank you. Is that better?
Yes, thanks.
Now you can't see me, so it must be better. I hear that a lot, so that's good. would be consistent. So my question is, in the current statute in the chart or in the table, and then the A6, both of them read $4 million for approximate revenue. But I believe either the base bill or A6, I'm not sure which one it is, basically takes away the advertising budget from OFREE, the ability to advertise. So I'm wondering why that wouldn't be a drop there or a difference, I guess, between those two.
Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson, my understanding is the following. So the funding mechanism, which is the per 1,000 board feet placed on logging or timber, brings in approximately $4 million over the recent years. So the rate doesn't change under the A6. And in fact, the rate itself doesn't change under the A7. So the A7 was the version that we heard last week, I want to say, where some of those funds in total, you still are, you know, the $4 million is the approximate amount, but some of those funds are being redirected. So that is a diversion that we have the sound forestry practices and the family forest lands. And then I think in the A6, what I think you're referring to looks like on page 6, line 22, it specifies that the Institute may not expend funds for certain kinds of advertising, radio or television related to certain practices. So that's a restriction on what they can do with the funds, but it's not specifically in the A6 taking the funds away or redirecting them or removing them in any way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before we get to Rep. Levy, I want to point out that when Representative Marsh noted that we have four things we could be comparing: current statute, the base bill, the A6 and the A7. The base bill is very much like the A7. The A7 makes changes to the appointment process, but some of those other or the any other components not related to the appointment process would be the same, if that makes sense. Rep. Levy.
Sorry, I have computer issues, so they're working behind the scenes. So, Ms. McGovern, can we go back to the intellectual property section? I just want to make sure that I understand it the way I think I understand it. And I understand that intellectual property means, so I have a bill that's coming before the floor that is exactly on intellectual property to protect a business in the community of Pendleton. And it's so that somebody who is working with them as a subcontractor is not allowed to take the what they see going on in that business and share it with some other business in another state and profit off of it. So basically, is that the understanding of this one? Because when it talks about patents and copyrights and trademarks, inventions, discoveries, processes, ideas, and other similar property, whether or not they're patentable or copyrightable, is this to protect those intellectual property rights? Is that what I'm seeing? Those specific property rights as they list them in page 4 of the A6.
Representative Levy, Chair Nathanson, I think my understanding of intellectual property and your understanding of intellectual property are the same or similar. That all makes sense to me. I'm reading on page, I have read and looking at page six, and I've sent out some, you know, questions to try and get a little bit of clarification about this. I don't have that yet, but, you know, in the, on page six, it has that OFRI can develop intellectual property and maintain, destroy. And I don't know, but we have a, you know, the timber industry, there's private companies involved and there may be proprietary information. I don't know what would be in that intellectual property, whether it would be timber sales or, you know, if this would be used for advertising. Those are the kind of questions I'm trying to source out. And when I get that, I will get back to you on that. But I don't think that we're defining a wholly new definition of intellectual property, but this gives OFRI the authority to develop intellectual property and then manage it. So okay. That's where I'm at right now.
Further comment, Chair?
Sure.
So, Ms. McGovern, back to this. So, we're farmers by nature, and the way we grow our crops and how we have refined that, we raise sheep. And so we have worked through the years to produce those sheep so that they're called scabie free. And that's a very hard process to get through. And we have our own method. And those are considered under our work, that's considered intellectual property.
Okay.
And so would that be defining the research that they do to make the trees grow healthier and produce a better wood? Would that also follow under that?
So these might be questions for LC that I'm going to have. This is branching into a little bit of legal question that I'm not familiar with. So I'll work on that and get back to you. Those are all important questions. Thank you
very much.
Thank you. We have some hands up, and I don't know if they are new or pre-existing, but I'll call on Rep. Pham, and that will be followed by Rep. Reschke and then Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I did just have a question about the advertising. So my understanding is that the A6, first of all, so if the advertising is changed, does the A6 still allow for digital advertising? And even if I understand that it doesn't allow for radio or TV, does it still allow for digital advertising for use of advertising around the logging industry?
Vice Chair Pham, Chair Nathanson, I don't see a prohibition in digital advertising in the A6.
Thank you very much.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. One is, I've heard the term publicly funded talked about, and I don't think this is publicly funded. I think it's an assessment on the industry. So I just wanted to make sure I'm clear on that. And second, the intellectual property part of the A6, I might be wrong, but just for Ms. McGovern to maybe research if other commodity commissions have intellectual property pieces in their charters. So I think that might be where that's coming from, but again, don't know. So those are my two comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Jamie, I have a question, and I realize these questions are going way outside what we would normally consider the appropriate revenue discussions, but these are in the amendment. I'm interested in the explicit statement around the participation of OFRI in the formulation and implementation of public policy through expressive activities, .. including legislation in an attempt to influence legislation or rulemaking. I am wondering if our other commodity commissions have such explicit approval to engage in lobbying. They may. I'm thinking about Travel Oregon. I mean, all of these are, that's not a commodity commission. It's a semi-independent commission, and they certainly lobby on legislation. But if it's possible, before we talk about this again, to get some understanding of how parallel that is to other similar state entities.
Thanks, Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson. I'll also just comment that in looking at this, commodity commissions generally, not OFRI, but timber is explicitly excluded from ORS 576, but that is where I've been finding, that is where we see the commodity commissions and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. So I'll get that list together for you as to the sort of marketing that they're authorized to do and encouraged to do under 576 for. There's 23 commodity commissions in Oregon. I think that's the right number currently. And then we can, you know, I might be able to make another grid that looks at what is here and then also what's in 576 or be able to get some information on that.
Thank you. I think that'd be very helpful, especially around some of the more controversial parts of this legislation.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, committee, I'm trying to get my arms around this issue. As I understand it, there's going to be a significant reduction in what OFRI will be allowed to do, which means that there'll be less expense. Do we anticipate, if this legislation passes, that whatever that reduction in expense is, will be proportionally reduced within the forest products harvest tax?
Representative Smith, Chair Nathanson. So in the A6, you won't see that reduction. The funds and the rate remain the same. In the A7, you'll see the total rate the rate is subject to a cap, but it's set by the board at OFRI. So subject up to the cap, the OFRI board can continue to set the rate. So assuming they set the rate at the same amount that they set it now, and timber volume was approximately the same as it was the last couple of years, the approximately $4 million would flow in under that rate. And then that reduction, I think that you're talking about, there's two new subaccounts that are created, and that's where the money would flow. One is the sound forestry practices, and that would receive about approximately half of the current fund, so $2 million. And then the other fund or subaccount is the family forest land subaccount, and that would receive about approximately $1.3 million. And then OFRI would receive approximately 0.7 million. So that would still make up the total of 4 million. That's under the A7. So that's what those, I guess, different policy options that are proposed in the amendments are. The total amount collected would stay the same under the A7. It would be, there would be three separate accounts that it would be going to.
And that just, Madam Chair, just as a comment, you know, if we want to bring equity to this issue, it would seem to me that we make a statement of no lobbying, if that's what's going on, but then those dollars that would have been historically used for that purpose would be returned back to the folks who pay it so they can go use it for other purposes. To me, that seems equitable. Thanks, Madam Chair. Appreciate you.
Thanks for the comment, Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Ms. McGovern, another question, please. So how many other commodities self-regulate themselves and tax themselves or put money into a fund besides OFRI?
Representative Levy, Chair Nathanson, in looking at this and talking with some people involved in the commodity commissions, the commodity commissions all set either fees or assessments on their members, and they're mandatory. I believe that either all or the majority of them are subject to a cap. They are all also subject to the restrictions and enumerations under 576. So in that sense, I don't know if I should say other commodity commissions, but the commodity commissions in 576 all put fee assessments on their members. And then there's a list of allowable activities that money is used for. And as Rep Marsh asked for, I'm going to be working on putting that list together for you so that you can see what the funds in those commodity commissions are used for. I hope that answers your question. If it does not.
Yes, it did. And I apologize to Rep Marsh. I missed that because that was when they were making my computer work. So thank you very much.
And Ms. McGovern, please correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but this is not a commodity commission, although in some ways its activities are like a commodity commission. As I understand it, a commodity commission establishes fees and collects them from the members. In this case, this organization is relying on the tax mechanism and a public process and a public agency to collect money, some of which it then uses like a commodity commission would use, but it's using a taxation and public process. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, there may be differences that I haven't discovered or things that I'm still learning, but yes, so timber is specifically excluded from the list of commodity commissions in 576, and those commodity commissions direct bill their members. So I think that's your question. The Oregon Forest Resources Institute assesses the per 1,000 board feet fee onto timber and as a tax, and then that money is sent to OFRI out of that tax.
Can I just interrupt for a moment? You used a terminology which was assess a tax. They may determine the rate, but aren't we using a public agency, Department of Revenue, to actually do the taxation?
Chair, I'm going to have to look into the mechanism, but you are absolutely correct that it is a tax versus direct billing. But in terms of what agency does that, I have to find a little bit more about the flow of the money.
I read one description that said it's the Department of Forestry that's assessing the tax. And I just didn't know which of those descriptions may have been correct. But either way, the difference is a tax and a public agency versus a direct bill. Okay. Thanks.
That's right. Thank you.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to remind the committee that this did pass out of the policy committee. It is a result of a lot of compromise and discussion. And I guess in echoing what Rep. Marsh said earlier, we usually I have some concerns about fundamentally shifting the debate with this A6 amendment and restoring the entire budget of the agency. And I mean, the intent of the bill is to really put some stronger restrictions, making sure it goes to very particular forest practices, supporting small woodlot owners, and limiting the lobbying support. So I guess I just want to reiterate the importance of really sticking with the intent and the intent of the policy committee that passed the bill to make sure that we're keeping within our lane. Thank you.
Representative Reschke and then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just looking at the vote out of the policy committee, it looks like it was along party lines. Representative Post was excused, but it looks like it was six to three, probably 6-4 if Rep Post were there. So I'm not sure how much compromise was done in that committee, but just to make sure that's clear and on the record.
Thank you. Rep Smith and then Rep Valderrama.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here looking at the Oregon Forest Resource Institute website. And my understanding isn't it, their website appears to agree with what I'm about to say, is that the Oregon Forest Research Institute is about forest research that's conducted, from what I can tell, at Oregon State University. And then they take that data and they disseminate it out to the public. And so part of the question I have is, are we questioning the research that it's not credible? And then two, the question I would have, Madam Chair, is where's that line between disseminating information, or in the case of Oregon State, educating the public versus lobbying? Because I can concur very easily that state resources should not be used for lobbying. I have no disagreement with that. What I'm trying to figure out is what's the difference between education of research and lobbying, disseminating information and lobbying.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Smith, for that question. I think where it comes to cross the lines is OFRI has actually, there's email evidence that was released during the investigative reports that OFRI's director, Aaron Eiselman, actively tried to undercut an Oregon State researcher who planned to survey the public perception of spraying herbicides in private forests to the researcher's dean. And they emails released by the journalists also showed that they were monitoring legislators. They were monitoring ballot measures, and actually this group that was supposed to be educating the public on forest practices is making comments such as, I don't think that representative is very smart, and just making basically basically crossing the line between forest research and, in this case, actually undermining forest research happening in our public universities that counteracts with what the logging industry asserts. So those are examples of when it's crossing the line in terms of lobbying.
No, that's interesting. I appreciate it. And again, I'm new to this, so I didn't know that background. I guess what I would add, Madam Chair, is maybe we need to strengthen that definition in this case and to provide those sidebars of what is allowed, because I would hate for us to undermine the dissemination of good information to the public when it's based upon sound research. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Rep. Valderrama, I think I saw your hand a minute ago.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just had put it down. Appreciate it. So I just wanted to kind of reiterate some of the comments that were made on the differences between the amendments, and also appreciate Representative Pham's comments of really wanting to make sure that we are being intentional about accountability here. I do think that in the investigations, at least that I've heard, that, you know, there was corruption that was revealed and a lack of accountability in OFRI. So I do think that there's been an intentionality that has been investigated in terms of misleading the public about the strength of our forest laws. And I think, again, it's important to lead with science and to make sure that we have credible agencies that we're investing in, and that we're not blurring the lines between state monies and what's being used for lobbying. So I really just wanted to lift up my preference for having an amendment and a bill that has strong accountability within the framework. And that's predominantly my concern with the Dash 6. Thank you for allowing me to share that.
We have hands again from Rep. Pham and Rep. Reschke. Oh, no. Okay, Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just to remind the committee that the Secretary of State is doing an audit on this organization. And it's my opinion that really we would be best served if we had that in hand before we made any movements forward on this topic. I appreciate the discussion and the chair leading the discussion, but I think we don't have something kind of neutral in our hands, as it were, to help us guide us where we should be going. Thank you.
Thanks for the comment. I'm looking through my notes from the public hearing, which was on May 10th. I'm looking through notes from testimony about people who said they did appreciate receiving information from the Forest Resources Institute. We also had public testimony about failing to provide information that might be appropriate for all of the forest land owners, some of the ones who might want to manage their land differently, perhaps, than the basic information that was relayed, and they were hoping for some alternative management practices and were unable to, felt that they weren't receiving that kind of information from the regular materials. Anyway, I'm just looking back through notes from the public hearing now. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to follow up on what you were saying, because I do also remember during the public hearing, some folks questioning or talking about the importance of small woodlot owner education programs. And I think that's why this switch is so important, because it actually can give small landowners more control over the education programs they receive and make sure that the programs are actually more relevant to the work that they're doing. Because right now, the board of OFRI is predominantly controlled by Big Timber, which means that a lot of the educational materials that they authorize and they endorse may not quite be what small woodlot owners actually need. And so by housing the education programs at the ODF, the Department of Forestry, then the influence of Big Timber will not be quite as prevalent. And so small woodlot owners can receive just more trainings that are relevant to their specific circumstances.
Thank you. I do still see a hand up from Rep. Smith. Maybe that's an additional question or comment now, Rep. Smith?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm still trying to wrap my arms around this issue and determine what's right and what isn't. I do want to caution us, though, as a group who's working together. We've got to be careful with what terminology we use, because when we use the words deception and corruption, those have implications. And we don't have to look very far to see a previous director at the Oregon Building Codes was accused of similar acts, only to be vindicated, and then the state wrote a check for $1 million to him. And so we've got to be really, really careful. And that's why I think the more I start listening, there's some real wisdom in what Rep. Reschke is sharing. Do we know, Madam Chair, when the Secretary of State will complete their work on the audit? Do we have any indication of that?
I'm going to ask LRO if they have a projected date. I've heard July, but I don't have a certain date. Does LRO have a date?
Chair Nathanson, I'm in the same situation. I've heard that date floated around, or that time period, but I don't have any updates.
Okay, thank you.
Well, just to follow up, Madam Chair, you know, if those statements are accurate, then there's no doubt in my mind we need to take swift action. But I'm also want to make sure that, you know, that we're guarded in doing the correct thing and having all the information in front of us. There's no reason this issue has to go away. There's no reason we couldn't continue to deal with this issue through legislative days and then take it up in February. And so I would just ask us collectively to be cautious as we proceed forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. I'm not seeing any other hands up right now, and we do have two other bills to do today. I'm going to wait just a few seconds to see if there are any final questions to make sure that if there's anything we need additional information on or clarification, that we get those to Ms. McGovern for LRO analysis or doing some digging for more information. Rep. Smith, I do see your hand. I don't know if that's from before or you do have one final question.
I promise you by the end of session, I'm going to learn how to put that down. I apologize. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's coming down. Thank you.
I think that appears to be the last of the questions and comments for right now. Wait another 3 or 4 seconds. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2357A. Thank you all. Now I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2819. This one also is for discussion purposes only. LRO.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Once again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, House Bill 2819, this is a bill relating to Oregon's earned income tax credit. And the committee did hear about this earlier in the session as well. You do have the introduced version and the dash 3 version. We have also included the dash 1 and the dash 2 amendments, but those were discussed at the previous hearing. So I was just gonna touch on the introduced version and the dash 3. To set up the discussion today, if that sounds good.
That's great, thank you.
Okay, so just as a quick refresher on Oregon's earned income tax credit. So there's an Oregon earned income tax credit and a federal earned income tax credit. And Oregon's EITC, as its the acronym is simply a percentage of that federal amount of the credit. So Oregon's earned income tax credit is either 9% of the federal credit amount or 12%. And the 12% is available to taxpayers who have a child under the age of 3 at the end of the tax year. So those taxpayers will get a higher percentage here in Oregon, which leads to a higher amount of the credit. And because Oregon's connected to the federal credit, Oregon also more or less connects to the provisions of the federal credit. So how the credit is structured, if there's a change at the federal level, that can cause a change here in Oregon. But one of the things with the federal credit is a limitation on taxpayers potentially being able to qualify or the amount they can qualify for the credit related to if they use an individual taxpayer ID number or what's referred to as an ITIN. So right now under federal law, there are limitations for taxpayers that use an ITIN rather than a social security number when they file their tax return and how they qualify for their earned income tax credit. So because of those federal limitations that are in law, Oregon is also then connected to those through our simple percentage of the federal credit amount. So with all that backdrop, House Bill 2819, the introduced version, what it would do is it would allow taxpayers that would otherwise qualify for the earned income tax credit here in Oregon, but for using an ITIN rather than an SSN, they would then qualify for the earned income tax credit. And in the case of the introduced version, they would qualify for the amount of the credit that they would otherwise qualify for at the federal level, plus that percentage, either 9 or 12%, that they would qualify for here in Oregon. So the introduced version is basically you get the Oregon credit amount, plus you'd also qualify for the federal portion. So Oregon would provide a credit that would backfill the federal portion. The dash three, by contrast, what that is doing is it's simply saying the taxpayer who uses an ITIN instead of a Social Security number would qualify for the Oregon portion of the credit. So they would determine that federal credit amount and then multiply that by their Oregon percentage, either 9 or 12%, to determine their Oregon credit amount. And so that's the difference between the dash three and the introduced version. Is the intro is the federal credit plus the Oregon amount. The dash three is the Oregon credit amount only. We don't have the paperwork at this time, Madam Chair. I do have some preliminary numbers I'm happy to share if that would be helpful for the discussion. And then we also have Ben Gilley from Department of Revenue to discuss things on the fiscal side.
Yes, let's hear about that, please.
Okay, so Madam Chair, in terms of a potential revenue impact, there is an expectation of an amendment coming as well, but assuming that, just to adjust the language to get this right in terms of Oregon's the dash three, but for the dash three amount, we'd expect that to be about starting about $5.7 million, ranging up to $6 million per year by expanding this credit to Oregon taxpayers that are filing with an ITIN, and that'd be their Oregon credit percentage amount. Now, of course, the introduced version would backfill that federal credit amount, which would lead to a much larger impact. So the introduced version would be more in the $60 to $70 million range per year, whereas the dash three is closer to that $6 million, a little bit less initially, growing a little bit in the outer years. But that's initial indication of the revenue impact. That's based upon information of looking at existing tax returns in the past few years that have been filed with an ITIN number and that would qualify for the earned income tax credit. So we do know, looking at back the recent past few years, that anywhere between 16,000 to 22,000 tax returns have been filed with an ITIN that would benefit from the changes in the dash three. And again, there can be some variation, as we've seen, that's just in the last few years. That can be a wide variation, 16,000 up to 22,000. And that really does speak to there can be some variation in this credit estimate going forward. But our estimate really is that point estimate that we think would be that middle ground of where Oregon we think would land in the coming years if the dash three amendment was made law, adopted and made law. But again, that's to give you some indication of where the revenue impact will land. And again, just introduced, we do have Ben Gilley from Department of Revenue who can speak to the potential fiscal side of things from the Department of Revenue's perspective.
Yes, Mr. Gilley, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson. Ben Gilley from the Oregon Department of Revenue. From a fiscal standpoint, we have started putting some of the numbers together. Again, we can refine it based on now the estimates of the 16,000 to 20,000 potential eligible people filing with ITINs. But in order for us to administer this, there are some what we will call big rocks that we'll need to do in order to effectively administer this. The current credit piggybacks off of the IRS. And so this one, for those ITIN filers, what we would need to do is create an Oregon-only schedule similar to what the IRS does to allow new filers to be able to calculate it and report it as part of the return. And then behind that, we'll have to do some programming with our system in order to process that return. With any new credit, so these ITIN filers have not filed in the past, and so we'll need to do some education. We would want to do some outreach to certain communities in order to let them know that they're now eligible to claim this. We will want to provide these forms and instructions and provide assistance in different languages. And then also, with the refundable component, what we do know is that we're going to need to do some enforcement in order to make sure that the people who are entitled to it really receive it. And so we'll put some edits up front in our processing system if we need to take a look at fraud components or also with new filers for a credit, there are going to be errors. We hope that is minimized by working with our software partners to program this. A lot of people who claim EITC right now use software because, again, it does all the heavy lifting with the calculation. But what we would do then is we would need to still assist people in trying to claim it correctly. And then we use that as a component, too, for education. If they don't claim the correct amount the first time, we'll work with them to explain what they need to do in order to file correctly the following year. And so regardless of whether it's the original version that's introduced or the Dash 3 amendments, we still have to set up all of those processes in our system in order to administer this expanded EITC program. Any questions?
Committee, any questions? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gilley, do you know how many of I-10 filers today use paper versus electronic means? I'm just wondering if it breaks down similarly, I can't say that word, folks that file their taxes with a Social Security number, if the ratio breakdown is similar or different.
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, very good question. I don't have that. What we have found is that, again, 95% of taxpayers use software to some degree. Of the 90% actually file electronic, but I can get that information for the committee. But what we generally find is some initial information is that this population tends to file, you know, the same as the normal population.
Rep Reschke, if you had a follow-up, I can't hear it right now. I'm going to call on Rep Pham, and if you have a follow-up, turn on your camera and let me know later. Rep Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question about the impact on Oregon children in particular. I know we learned from the public hearing that children who grow up in families that received earned income tax credits have better educational outcomes and health outcomes. So I heard some numbers overall about the general population, but Kyle, do you have questions? Do you have specific numbers around the number of Oregon children that would benefit if we were to expand the earned income tax credit to I-10 filers?
Yeah, Representative Pham. So we do have good information on the makeup of existing earned income tax credit filers. I haven't looked specifically at the dependent characteristics of I-10 filers at this time, but that is something we can look at more going forward. But in terms of using what does the existing earned income tax filers look like, how many children do they have, and applying that to just the number of returns on the I-10 side gives us a pretty good initial look. And that would put it in probably 20,000 to 25,000. In this case, these would be dependents that are likely to qualify for the earned income tax credit. So again, there are already limitations in place, the age limitations and such. But that would be a pretty good indication that we think it'd be between 20,000 and 25,000 would be associated with those returns that we'd pick up that would be dependents on a tax return that could benefit from this expansion of the EITC.
So 20,000 to 25,000 children, is that just to clarify? Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions for Mr. Easton or discussion, committee discussion about this amendment? I'm not seeing any additional questions or comments. I'll wait just another few seconds. Okay, I think that concludes our work on House Bill 2819 for today. Except Representative Reschke, I see your hand now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you'll be able to hear me though, so.
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. I just appreciated the, just wanted to say I appreciated the Dash 3 amendment. I think it makes the, when I look at new tax credits or extending tax credits, my first question is always cost. And so I think the estimate on the base bill was quite high, I guess I'd say, and this seems more reasonable. So I appreciate the data. I'm still trying to
Oh dear, committee, are you hearing Rep. Reschke? I missed the last comments. I'm not, Rep. Reschke, I'm sorry, we're not able to hear you right now. Try again one more time before I close the work session. I think it's not working.
That's it, yeah.
I think he was just trying to say you're awesome.
Jeez. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'll try to echo, I think, what Reschke was expressing, which is that I think the Dash 3 is a really important step forward. It is true that we would like to do more, and the numbers were really big on the original proposal. But this is a really important statement that we believe that this benefit that we provide here in Oregon should be available to all taxpayers, regardless of immigration status. And it is also, as we know, a really effective way at helping people to build a little bit of security and be able to take care of debts or do things in their lives that they aren't able to do normally. So I do appreciate the flexibility and the creativity in coming up with the Dash 3 amendment.
Thank you.
He meant to say
Rep. Smith?
He meant to say that as well. Sorry.
Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson. I also just wanted to share my appreciation for Representative Pham on this bill. This is something that I think, again, when we look at the intention and the impact that it could provide for children and I-10 filers, families of I-10 filers, I think it's an incredible opportunity that we have. And so just very much appreciate the work that's gone into this. And I think that, again, the amendment is based on lots of conversations with the community, really thoughtful collaboration and coordination. And I'm just really appreciative. So.
Thank you for the comment. I'm not seeing any other questions. Before I close this work session, Mr. Easton or Mr. Alanak, any other final points you want to make before we move away from this topic? Not seeing any.
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2819. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2434. And as LRO is getting ready to describe it for us, Manny, the last I heard, no one had signed up for the public hearing. Is that still correct?
Yes, that is still correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. LRO, House Bill 2434.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue. This bill would require the Legislative Revenue Office to study options for reforming Oregon's revenue system and report those findings to the legislature by February of next year. It does specify some information to be included. For example, it would require the report to include options for maintaining stability, reducing inequality, and raising revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Allenack. And committee, this is one of those bills that can be used. Sometimes it's described as a placeholder. This bill is now available for us to use as a tool if we need to make any other adjustments to our tax policies. So the bill, we're having a public hearing. There are no witnesses to call for testimony. Any questions for Mr. Allenack? Any discussion before I close the public hearing? LRO, any final comments before we close the public hearing?
No, Madam Chair, that about sums it up.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2434. Committee members, any last words, or Rep. Reschke, anything you wanted to add when you've been interrupted by technology earlier in the meeting?
No, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Mr. Allenack, anything final for the committee before we adjourn?
No, Madam Chair, that completes your agenda.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow. We're adjourned.